Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the federal defense, or a key provision of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, opening up the door to same-sex couples married in states where it is legal now. The court also ruled that traditional marriage proponents who put Proposition 8 on the California ballots in 2000 and 2008 did not have the constitutional standing to defend the law in federal courts. Joining us now to break it down, thankfully, are two professors from the OSU Moritz College of Law, Mark Spindelman, who specializes in family law. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And also Ruth Kolker. She was with us last summer when we covered the Obamacare decision. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
It was a divided ruling in both cases, and the court declined to make a more sweeping statement on the broader issue of same-sex marriage rights nationwide. And Ruth, that was in many ways a fatal flaw for a lot of people.
Well, fatal flaw might be an overstatement. It reflected the court's very incremental, cautious approach to these issues. And I think we should all remember that we think of the judiciary as a conservative institution, because we want the democratic process, if at all possible, to resolve important moral political questions. And so if the court is going to rule that what a legislature did was unconstitutional, typically they will take a small step and not a sweeping step. There have been, of course, exceptions to that rule, like Roe versus Wade is a huge exception. But I think most of the court has tried to learn from the Roe versus Wade experience to take a much more incremental step, and that's what they did yesterday.
So this is more typical, Mark?
Well, I have a slightly different reading of the decision than my esteemed colleague does. I think that the decision, although it wasn't as big of a step as the Court of Appeals had taken in the case, took a quite a significant step in the direction of marriage equality yesterday. The court, all that it had to do to resolve the issue in favor of striking down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act was to say that this was an unusual piece of federal legislation in relation to the tradition that we have in our country of states regulating and defining marriage, and that when there was a deviation from that unusual situation, it called for a special kind of justification for the law that the statute here didn't have and couldn't offer. But what the court did was, it did say that. But it then went on to say that we don't decide this as a matter of federalism. It went on to decide this as a matter of equality. And although there's important federalism language that the Chief Justice in his dissenting opinion in the Windsor case said really is the true basis for the decision, the true basis for the decision, as the majority seemed to outline its position, what was a principle of equality. The sameness, the likeness of same-sex and cross-sex marriages, the sameness, the likeness of cross-sex relationships. And it's that special equality, the equality of same-sex and cross-sex relationships, families, and marriages, that marked what the federal government did in banning and not recognizing those relationships as distinctive, triggering that form of closer look.
And by doing that, is it possible that courts down the road, lower federal courts, will return to that as justification or validation for overturning?
Yeah, Justice Scalia issued a very powerful and a very, 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 very angry dissenting opinion.
I want to go through that almost point by point, but go ahead, Mark Spindelman.
So his powerful and angry dissenting opinion said, you know, the majority opinion effectively contains all of the seeds for the a decision down the road. Could be next year, could be sometime farther down the road, recognizing marriage equality, not simply by striking down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, but by saying state bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional across the country.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests right now, we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decisions announced yesterday regarding same-sex marriage, the Proposition 8 question, and also the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. With me, Ruth Kolker. She's Distinguished University Professor and the Heckfast Memorial Chair in Constitutional Law at the Moritz College of Law at OSU. And Mark Spindelman is a professor of the Moritz College of Law at OSU as well, and he specializes in family law. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So, in a practical matter, and I do want to get back to Justice Scalia's remarks, because he made a lot of really interesting comments that I wonder about. But how much change in federal policy will this require? How it's reported that hundreds of employment tax and other benefits previously denied will now be available. How sweeping is this, Ruth?
It is very sweeping. As the majority opinion itself noted, more than 1,000 federal policies are implicated by DOMA. 1,000. So we're not just talking about the estate tax that was at issue for Ms. Windsor. We're talking about everything, especially including our federal income taxes. April 15th next year is going to be very complicated. And as Mark and I were discussing earlier, the federal government is going to have to issue regulations to advise people who are married in our same-sex couples as to how they should handle their federal income taxes.
Why do they have to release special regulations? Why not? Why isn't it just now part of the deal? Or do they have to have a new a little thing to check on your tax form?
Well, there's going to be some new issues that have never arisen before. For example, Mark and I had a student a few years ago who was married to his partner in Massachusetts and then came to live in Ohio to attend law school. Is he married when it comes to filing a federal income tax because he lives in Ohio? Or would he use his status as a married person in Massachusetts to file that federal income tax return? I read in today's New York Times that people are anticipating, but no one knows, that the Obama administration might issue regulations that says for federal income tax purposes, it will be the state in which you got married that determines your marital status for federal income tax purposes. If that's what they do, and I don't have any crystal ball to know that that's what they do, then one could imagine that someone could be married for the purposes of federal income tax law, but not married for the purpose of state income tax law in the short term.
I read in the Plain Dealer today that the decision also creates questions for the Ohio Department of Taxation, which will have to review its impact on same-sex couples who live in Ohio but were legally married elsewhere, because current law says that state taxes in Ohio, state law must be filed with the same status claimed on federal tax filings. That's from the Ohio Department of Taxation spokesman Gary Gunmanson.
Right. And I was thinking this morning that TurboTax is going to have to really refigure the questions that it asks, because right now those tax programs do presume that your federal tax status is your same as your state tax status. In Ohio, of course, we have a mini DOMA that precludes the state from recognizing same-sex marriages as marriages. So it's going to be complicated, I think.
It's going to be complicated. What about family law issues, Mark Spindleman?
So the ruling is complicated in all sorts of ways. So in a sense, although we're talking about tax law, these tax laws are family law related as much as anything else. So lots of complicated questions that are going to come up in the context of family law, including for families in states like Ohio where people are not married. So for instance, there are these questions that have been percolating in the state, given that we have a statutory and a constitutional Defense of Marriage Act. What happens if you go, say, to another state where marriage is legal, get married, you come back, you live in Ohio, you're a resident of Ohio, and you want to get a divorce? There are questions about whether, given the statutory and constitutional defense of marriage bans, whether you can actually get a divorce in the state of Ohio. And the reason is because in the state of Ohio, you're not even recognized as being married, so there's no marriage to end. So in those cases, for instance, the Supreme Court's decision with its recognition of marriage equality, if in the limited context of the federal Defense of Marriage Act for now, seems to have likely to have some reverberations in family law in areas not directly related to the question of whether you can marry, but related sort of indirectly through the question of whether you can get divorced.
So if it's in the state where the marriage took place, that covers children of same-sex couples now. They're not going to have to belong to one or the other when it comes to Social Security benefits and that sort of thing?
So there are questions of state law and there are questions of federal law. The questions of federal law, I think Ruth has her finger on the pulse here, where she notes that undoubtedly, because these questions are complex, they're arising for the first time for same-sex couples as broadly as they are, there's going to be clarification that comes out. But what I think is important to recognize is that the Supreme Court's decision, insofar as it's a decision about the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, is not, at least so far, or in the immediate future, a decision about the legitimacy of state bans on same-sex marriage or the regulations of families under state law, it won't have an effect on children under state law or for state law purposes, but only perhaps for the purposes of federal benefits and so forth.
Yeah, Ruth?
One really interesting issue that I think will arise soon that's something that Mark and I both know a lot about. In Ohio right now, if you are a woman and you give birth to a child and you're a lesbian and your partner is a woman, you are not allowed to request that your female partner be the second person listed on the birth certificate so that your child can have two legally recognized parents of the same sex. Okay, so hopefully you got that. In the DOMA decision, Justice Kennedy has tremendously long language about the benefits to children of having their parents legally recognized as a married couple. He seems to be understanding the value to children of having stability in their life with having two legally recognized parents. So will that language from the DOMA decision be used now in state courts like Ohio to say it is unconstitutional for the state of Ohio to not allow a woman who's given birth to a child to choose a female partner as the second person on the birth certificate?
Can a woman now choose a male partner who may not be the child's biological father and put them on the birth certificate?
That's a complicated question in
Ohio.
I'm
sure it happens all the time.
Right.
But
There are routes to having that happen.
Okay.
There are paths to having that happen. There is no path for a woman or a man right now to have a child with two people of the same sex. Ohio is unusual. We're an outlier. Most states that even do not allow two people of the same sex to be married do allow two people of the same sex to be on the birth certificate. Mm. So if you move to Michigan, you could do that, even though they don't recognize same-sex marriage. So I just mentioned that to say, because Kennedy's decision in DOMA is rooted in part on the effects of children, I could imagine someone taking that language from the decision and saying, although Kennedy wasn't talking about state rights at all, how can we, in light of what the Supreme Court has said about that value to children, now not extend that right to same-sex couples having legally recognized rights over their children on the birth certificate?
Yeah, I just want to share what some of this language is, because it's really quite stunning. So this is Justice Kennedy speaking for the court on page 23 of the opinion for anybody who wants to look it up. He says, this is of the Defense of Marriage Act, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. It, quote, humiliates tens of thousands of children now being raised by same-sex couples. Humiliates. That's a really powerful word to use in this context. And it's not a word that applies, exactly as Ruth is saying, only to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act with its failure to recognize the lawfulness of marriages lawful in the state in which they were celebrated. It's a principle or a point that applies to same-sex couples more generally, exactly as Justice Kennedy himself wrote it for the court.
We are talking about the United States Supreme Court rulings yesterday on the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level and also Proposition 8 out of the state of California. If you have a question or comment with us, Ruth Kolker and Mark Spindleman, both professors at the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University, are with us. Coming up in a little while, Alan Johnson from the Columbus Dispatch will join us to chat about the issue of putting something on the ballot to overturn the constitutional ban on same-sex marriage in the state of Ohio and where that's at. And we'll also later on be hearing from Carlo Rothen of Stonewall Columbus. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, taking the stage at the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium for the 8th season of Jazz Zoo. The CJO plays four Friday concerts, July 12th and 19th, and August 2nd and 16th. Tickets, reserve tables, and full series details at jazzartsgroup.org.
You're mobile, and we are too. 89.7 NPR News is now available anytime, anywhere, with the WOSU Public Media mobile app. Get your headlines on demand, listen to live streaming of 89.7, and your favorite podcasts like All Sides with Ann Fisher, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered. It's free and available for iPhone, iPad, and Android devices. Just go to WOSU.org/mobile app and download the app today.
A basic membership for 89.7 NPR News starts at just $60 and comes with our airfare program guide and a grocery tote. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yesterday, the United States Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional of an important provision in the Defense of Marriage Act, and also overturned Proposition 8 in California. With us in the studio to talk about that, Ruth Kolker and Mark Spindelman, both professors of law at the Moritz College of Law at OSU. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to get into the noteworthy dissent of Justice Scalia on the DOMA ruling. You guys can just add in whatever you want, but first of all, he said that the Supreme Court has no power to invalidate democratically adopted legislation. And I thought that that's absolutely what the U.S. Supreme Court had the power to do.
Well, what's so funny about that is that he joined the majority just very recently, striking down the vote, a very, very important provision, the heart of the Voting Rights Act. So how can he say with a straight face that the court doesn't have that power, because he has frequently joined the power join the court majority when it's been striking down federal legislation?
Did he give any roots of validity to this? I mean, what was he talking about?
Well, I think that part of what Justice Scalia has in mind is a particular, from his perspective, I'm just trying to describe his view here, a kind of arrogance that he perceives in the majority's approach to the question. A notion here that the majority of the court is insisting and inserting itself into the resolution of this matter in a way that precludes the political processes from operating the way that they have been operating and should ordinarily operate, absent some special mandate that justifies the court intervening to, in a sense, put a stop to some particular action by the government. And so part of this is a reflection of his views that the Constitution does not speak in any way to the constitutionality of bans on same-sex marriage. They're permissible if the democratic processes produce them. And it's also permissible if they choose to allow same-sex marriage. That's a political question in his view, not a question that the Constitution resolves one way or the other. That being the case, when the Supreme Court steps in to declare a law like the Federal Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional, it's arrogating power to itself. It's aggrandizing itself at the expense of the political process, which ought to be allowed to work its way and to have its will on the question.
Wasn't the Constitution written in a way that would allow for, say, changes and things that they couldn't have dreamed of, wouldn't have itemized in the Constitution at the time? Wasn't that the way it was written, to allow for change in society?
Well, that's a big controversy, obviously, within the court. There's those who believe that the Constitution is a living Constitution. To some people, this idea that it's a living constitution is a four-letter word. They think that the Constitution only means what it was intended to mean at the time of ratification. Interestingly, Justice Kennedy, in writing for the court in the DOMA case, does not endorse that view, even though we think of him as one of the conservative members of the court. And to me, even more interestingly, Chief Justice Roberts, in his dissent, does not join that language of Justice Scalia's. He wrote a separate dissent. He joined Scalia's dissent in part, but he did not join the ranting and raving that Mark just quoted from. He only joined the part on standing. He didn't join the part where he talked about cheek.
Let's take a call from Paul in Pickerington. You have a question about standing. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering how much effect the issue of standing will have on future efforts to overturn state bans. For instance, if a state like Oregon has a governor and an attorney general who will not appeal a lower court decision, do you think that that'll have much impact on the spread of the legality of marriage equality across the country?
So some of it. Thanks, Paul, for the question. So some of this may depend on what the law that's being challenged is. Part of the reason why the Supreme Court said in Perry, the California Proposition 8 case, that the defendant interveners who had helped put the measure on the ballot didn't have standing, is because to appeal the trial court decision overturning Proposition 8, is that they themselves didn't have a concrete and particularized injury, that they weren't themselves injured. But contrast that with the kind of injury that Edie Windsor said that she suffered when she wasn't allowed to have the benefits of federal protection for her relationship as a marriage. So in that, what I mean to say by that is she had a kind of particularized injury. So it depends on the setting and the context and who's challenging what kind of ban. So in the cases challenging bans on same-sex marriage, same-sex couples arguably have particularized concrete personal injuries. There are certain kinds of benefits, like Edie Windsor was arguing that she was entitled to, that people are being disallowed under state law in virtue of state bans on same-sex marriage. So it's not exactly the same. I understand and appreciate the concern about the potential for the standing ruling in Perry to be disadvantageous, but for proponents of same-sex marriage and people who are challenging state bans on same-sex marriage, but I think you have to be aware of and look at the context in which those challenges come up.
Okay. Paul, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Let's get back to Scalia real quick before we take a few more calls. There was one article, it was entitled Top 10 Rage Quotes. From Scalia's DOMA dissent. So he was very angry. I wondered just about in terms of tone, is it typical, the kind of tone he used in his dissent? Is it typical for him? Is it typical for anybody?
Scalia is well known for his use of the English language, his broad and vitriolic use of the English language. He wrote a dissent, maybe not quite as strong in Lawrence, where the court had concluded the sodomy statutes were unconstitutional. So I think we were all expecting a lively Scalia dissent if this were to be the decision. Even for him, I'd say this was a 10. But Justice Ginsburg this week, you know, wrote some strong dissents when she was unhappy with the court's Title VII opinions, which she also read from the bench. Her demeanor isn't exactly the same as Scalia's. I wasn't there to hear it, but she's much more soft-spoken. So it's unusual for someone to read a dissent from the bench. It's unusual for someone to use such strong language, but I think Scalia prides himself on his strong language.
Yeah, there's a difference between a strong dissent and a dissent that has very, very powerful, colorful language, the way that Justice Scalia's does. But I do have to say that the decision, his dissenting opinion, is absolutely gripping reading. It really forces and draws the readers into a kind of emotional engagement with the text. And I think it's important to say, in defense of Justice Scalia's opinion, that there's a sense in which I think he importantly and powerfully has his pulse, his finger on the deep, deep pulse of the majority's opinion. Part of what he says is, if you read the majority's opinion carefully, there are all sorts of passages that are written, like perhaps the passage about humiliating children that I mentioned before. The language there is, you know, sort of being raised by same-sex couples. It's not by people in same-sex marriages. And what Justice Scalia's point was, he has this passage in his opinion where he quotes from the majority opinion in Windsor and says, take these passages and with tiny, tiny tweaks, you can actually imagine these passages being written into the next decision recognizing marriage equality on a national level. And so I think one has to take that decision very, very seriously in no small part because Justice Scalia correctly perceives the direction, not only that the country is taking, but that the Supreme Court seems to be taking as well.
And real quick, he criticized the Obama administration for refusing to defend DOMA. Would that have made a difference?
On the standing issue, it would have. You know, remember, four members of the court concluded in DOMA that actually there was no standing for this case to be heard for some of the same reasons the Prop 8 case was found to not have standing, because since the Obama administration didn't defend it, instead the bipartisan legal advocacy group, BLAG, was the one who defended it. And so had the Obama administration been the one to defend it, then the four justices who dissented would not have had that option for their ruling. We would then know how Chief Justice Roberts stands on this issue. We do not know how Chief Justice Roberts stands because he only ruled on the standing issue. So ironically, it could have been 6-3 had the Obama administration chosen to defend it, because maybe Roberts would have gone with Kennedy.
Or maybe not.
But we don't
we'll
know.
Never know.
Roberts could have joined Scalia, you know, in terms of reaching the merits, and chose not to. That's important to know.
I want to welcome to the show now Alan Johnson, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
I wanted you to talk to us about Ohio's ban on gay marriage. It passed as a constitutional amendment in 2004. What is going on right now with the two different groups that have formed to change that?
Well, that's a good question, because there seems to be a split in the gay-lesbian community about whether or not that should be challenged on the ballot in 2014 when there's a governor's election, or 2016, which would be the presidential election. And I don't really think that a firm decision has been made, because some of the local folks in Ohio think next year is a better way to go at it, a better time. But a lot of the national groups that came into Columbus just aren't sure that that's the time and that the money will be available. So there's kind of a schism between the groups and the community in general about when to go.
Freedom Ohio, the group pushing to get it on the November 2014 ballot, said that the decisions give more momentum to the effort and that they're going to go forward, you know, great guns now, gathering those signatures to get it on the ballot.
And that is right. Ian James is the leader of that group and is very vocal and very passionate about it, and very works very hard, and has got a lot of the signatures to get it on the ballot. I think from the national perspective, from the other groups, I think they're more concerned not so much about the timing as about the money, because it is going to be an extraordinarily expensive battle. $10 million would be, you know, a small drop in the bucket probably for what this is going to take to get, as far as a campaign is concerned. Mm-hmm. So I think their idea is, they're not saying no to 2014. They're just saying, we're not really sure. We're not sure the time is right. We're not sure that the money would be there for that time. So I think they're a little bit undecided, but you're absolutely correct. The Ohio-based folks are very gung-ho about next year.
Now, it should be noted, I mean, it's not that it might not pass or not. It's the money involved. Ohio is a very expensive state to run a ballot issue in.
Yes, because we have so many TV media markets. You can't just place it in Columbus or Cleveland. You also have to consider Toledo and Cincinnati, and even some of the West Virginia markets that bleed over into Ohio and Dayton, of course. And there's so many markets in the state that must be considered, that you have to buy TV commercials to be on all of those markets, or a significant number of them, and that makes it very expensive.
Drew in Columbus, you're on the air. Did you have any more questions for Alan Johnson?
No, I believe I answered my question.
All right. I just want to make sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, so when are we going to know, Alan, what the scoop is? When is anybody said, or they just keep plowing ahead in parallel universes?
Well, there was a very big meeting a couple weeks ago here that involved players from all of the major national groups that was here in Columbus. And when the meeting was over, there was, well, depending on your who was in the meeting, there was either a consensus that they had not reached consensus or that there was a consensus that they would go ahead next year. And so there is a deep division among the groups about that. But I'll tell you, Ann, the one thing I did pick up yesterday is, despite the feelings about when it should go, there is a very, very strong emotional cord that runs through the folks in the gay lesbian community about this. I was really kind of taken by that when I talked to them. There were a lot of tears and a lot of deep emotions that run through this issue that I guess I'm not surprised, but I really felt that they feel it very strongly. So whether it's going to be next year or in 3 years, I think it's going to be quite a battle.
All right. Well, Alan Johnson, thanks for joining us today. Ruth, Mark, anything you want to add to that? Nope. Shaking heads. Okay, Alan Johnson, thank you so much for squeezing us in today. We really appreciate it. Take care.
No problem. Thanks, Ann. Bye-bye.
We have an email from Randy. He said, would the addition of a second female partner slash spouse on a child's birth certificate be to the exclusion of the name of the child's father? Should we anticipate the addition of a second male partner spouse on a birth certificate to the exclusion of that of the child's mother? What are the rights of the child to ultimately know the identity of their biological parents aside from the vanity issues of a same-sex couple?
Well, the reason I use the example I use is that typically when a woman who's a lesbian chooses to give birth, it will be through artificial insemination. And we have laws in Ohio, as does every state, that says that when the man chooses to use a sperm bank or whatever to be a donor through artificial insemination, that his parental rights are terminated. And it's for his benefit, really, as much as anyone's, because otherwise she could go after him for child support. Mm-hmm. So already we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of children around the country who have been born through that mechanism. And so it's already a matter of state law that man's name is not on the birth certificate. So really the question is whether that child is entitled to a second parent on the birth certificate who would be by consent of the biological mother. It's a little more complicated with men, but it can happen with men, obviously, as well.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Hi. I would encourage people to read the decision, which you can get on a PDF file or something like that. Once you get past the legalese and the standing bit for the first few pages, which most of us aren't going to be interested in, it's really understandable. I think the greatest change this will make is that it really lays out the case for human decency and in just a larger context. This is an evolving idea that, gee, these people have rights there. They've been picked out with animus was the word they used. They've been singled out for discrimination in DOMA. And I think that's going to have a very broad social implication, that both it lays that out and will help set that on further, but it also represents our cultural change in that respect.
Any comments either?
Well, one thing I would add there, which is just interesting as a matter of judicial development, typically when a group is the most discriminated against, when they're really at their low point in terms of the way society treats them adversely, they don't get legal rights. It's only after we see the political process move forward as it has here, and we have 13 states now recognizing same-sex marriage, it's only then that the court will sort of get into the game and say, oh, yeah, we agree, too. This is inappropriate to discriminate against these groups. And so one irony here is California, which is certainly one of the more progressive places for same-sex couples to live, you know, will now move towards same-sex marriage, but Alabama, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi will not, neither will Ohio, at least immediately. So more rights attach in a judicial setting after the political process has itself taken some important steps.
There's to build on that in a little bit of a different direction. When the majority opinion is talking about the animus that it sees at work, both in purpose and effect, around the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. There's an important way in which Justice Scalia points out that this is problematic, and problematic not just because it imputes a kind of hatred that may not be there to the duly elected members of the Congress and to the president who signed the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. But he also is pointing out that, in a different way, indirectly, that that proponents of same-sex marriage can easily describe opponents in similar terms, but that it's important to recognize, not just for purposes of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, that there were arguably other kinds of non-animus-based reasons, things like uniformity, stability, that could be understood to justify the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. That argument didn't carry the day. But that more significantly, that there's an importance, and the irony is not lost, but Justice Scalia's dissent, in a sense, is an attempt at a certain moment in it to call the sides to conversation. Now, it may not be this dissent, it may not be the best vehicle for delivering that message for respectful debate.
Get together
debate.
In a room and talk.
But it's in there. But it's in there, right? Okay. It's in there.
Ruth?
Well, it is. I wrote a book many years ago about the importance of good faith dialogue in the abortion context. And I would not, from what I've read about good faith dialogue, he did not plant the seeds of such dialogue in his opinion. Others might, but I think we'd have to look long and hard to find the seeds. I would say, though, in terms of opinions, that Justice Kennedy himself is known for writing very emotional opinions. And this is one of his very emotional opinions. He uses the words demean, degrade, humiliation. And so I think it's funny how the men on the court are the really emotional ones. Justice Ginsburg is silent, as is Kagan and Sotomayor on this area. But so we got both these men emoting.
Mike, thanks for your question. We will continue our conversation. I want to get to some in the next segment, some comments from opponents of same-sex marriage and hear what they have to say. We tried to get organizations to speak on the show and didn't. We're unable to do so this time, so we want to make sure we get those voices heard. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Member contributions are the largest source of funding for 89.7 NPR News. Your support provides for the highest quality news and information. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we still have about $50,000 to raise. You can help us meet our annual goal by giving at WOSU.org or by calling 866-897-9678. And thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
In commercial radio, in-depth means a minute 30. On much of public radio, you can hear stories stretched to 6 or 7 minutes. On Talk of the Nation, we're not talking in depth until we've hit the half-hour mark. I'm Neil Conan. Take your time with the discussion on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons at 2 on 89.7 NPR News. Discover more about WOSU with the FYIE newsletter. Get emails with program highlights and much more. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court rulings yesterday regarding same-sex marriage, striking down an important provision in the Defense of Marriage Act and also Proposition 8 in the state of California. Not surprisingly, social conservatives were not pleased with the court's rulings. Here is Reverend Rob Shank of the Evangelical Church Alliance. The Evangelical Church Alliance is an interdenominational association of Christian ministers that serves the goal of spreading the Christian religion. Here he is responding after the decisions were announced.
No matter how any of us feel about the outcomes in these cases, one thing is true. The Supreme Court has no authority when it comes to the nature of marriage. That authority belongs to the Creator, whom our founders declared is the source of all our rights.
Okay. So still with us in the studio, Ruth Kolker and Mark Spindleman of the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. And joining us now, Carla Rothan, the executive director of Stonewall Columbus. Welcome to the show, Carla.
Thank you.
So what about that idea of redefining marriage? What rights do the courts have? What's your reaction to that, Ruth?
Well, what DOMA itself does in the section that was at issue is the federal government itself decided to define the word marriage as applied to the entire United States Code. It was Congress that got into the game of defining marriage. It was then up for purely legal purposes, not for religious purposes. It wasn't saying who the Catholic Church has to marry or not. And so all the court was asked to decide was whether Congress acted constitutionally in creating this particular definition. It wouldn't have mattered if what it was defining was Hogwarts. Anytime Congress defines something, it has to do so within constitutional norms. But there is nothing in the court's opinion or Congress's action that has to do with the religious definition of marriage, and it does not in any way change, and never will change, whether religious institutions are required to marry any particular people.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
The significance of the comment, I think, goes back to the point about Justice Scalia's view about whether the court has any constitutionally grounded warrant to say that laws barring same-sex marriage violate the Constitution. The court does this in the Windsor case, in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act case, through an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution and its Due Process Clause, which, as the Supreme Court has interpreted it, has important equality components or dimensions to it. But that's an interpretation of the document. And it's not something that if you go and read the Constitution, you will find in it expressly in any terms. Although I think it's also important to note that if you read the Constitution itself, you will not find the right to marry itself mentioned. And so the right to marry as a constitutional concept is also a right that's protected by virtue of Supreme Court interpretation. So lots of this comes down to the legitimacy of particular kinds of interpretations that the Supreme Court gives to the Constitution, and what modes of interpretation are legitimate. Some believe only what the original founders meant or what was meant at the time of the founding. Others, to go back to the conversation you were having with Ruth before, others understand the Constitution's meaning to be an evolving one. But those are questions of legitimacy as much as anything else.
So, Carla Rothan, just generally, the response in Columbus, where it is still illegal, same-sex marriage is illegal in the state of Ohio by virtue of the Constitution now. And what happens going forward? We already talked to Alan Johnson about the conflict between the two groups seeking to overturn that on the ballot, whether it's in 2014 or 2016. But are there going to be a bunch of people in Ohio at least taking off and getting married in other states now? I mean, is the wedding industry losing money?
Oh, definitely. Yes, of course.
They can come back to have their
always comes down to the bottom line.
Here, though,
yes. We talked about this yesterday. I guess I didn't realize it, but you know, NPR was at my office and we were on the live blog, and so I turned to Linda was on my landline and I had my advisor on my cell phone and we're going through it, and it says DOMA is unconstitutional. And I said, "Honey, will you marry me?" And so that was all over NPR yesterday. So I guess I'm committed, but we can't do it here in Ohio. So I think that probably people will go and they will get married in other states, and they will have their weddings there. Of course, they'll come back to Ohio, and they won't have any rights. We know that,
but they'll have federal
rights.
Benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, and so that's important for a lot of folks, because you know, up until now, many people were getting married in other states or even getting married in Ohio, and it really, they were not treated equally as far as being able to file jointly if they choose to do so, getting each other's Social Security benefit. And, you know, even in, for instance, in Washington, if you work for a place that we have to, you're married and you get your insurance for, through your spouse, right? We would be taxed on that. That was considered a taxable benefit. So, you know, now that I'm hoping that that will not be the case. So, you know, when you have...
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, just to clarify, we don't yet know whether someone moves to... goes to P-Town and gets married in Massachusetts. We don't know whether that person will be able to take advantage of the federal benefits. The Obama administration is going to have to issue guidance on that because we usually it's the state in which you live rather than the state in which to consummate the marriage. So that we don't know
that.
Even
if you work for a company that recognizes same-sex marriages, you know, and the benefits go to the partner of the person employed there, those are taxed. Those benefits are taxed.
Well, until
as income.
Until yesterday, they were taxed for everybody in the country as income.
Okay.
Today, if you're living in Massachusetts and you're married under the state law of Massachusetts, that will no longer be a taxable benefit. In Ohio, if you are married in Massachusetts and move to Ohio, we do not know whether for federal income tax purposes that will be a taxable benefit. That's one of the issues the Obama administration is going to have to offer some guidance on.
Okay. Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting, Brian.
Not a problem, man. You guys started to allude to my question, but I have a question about how this affects military people. If you're a gay man and you're married to your partner in a state that's legalized marriage, and let's say you get transferred, you as the Army person or whatever, military person, you get transferred to a state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, or better yet, you get transferred to a country where that's not recognized. How does federal benefits affect that individual and his or her spouse?
That's actually an easy question, because I assume you're living on a military base in your hypothetical, and if you're living on a military base, you're governed by federal law entirely. You're not governed by state law or the law of the country in which you're living. Now, if you retire from the military and stay in that state, your status could change.
Hmm. Okay, Brian?
Okay, thank you. That's what I wanted to know. Yeah,
all right.
Have a good day.
Thanks. Bob in Akron, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, real quick question and observation. Let's say a corporation, small, medium, large, has employees in one state that do not allow, you know, gay marriages. But they may have a small firm over there in Massachusetts or whatever that do allow gay marriages. How is this going to affect the people that are in that non-state when people in the Massachusetts state are getting those benefits, but the people, let's say, down in North Carolina aren't?
Okay.
What is the effect on business?
Well, I think that Mark and I are both expecting that in the short term we're going to see further challenges to state marriage laws beyond the one that the court considered yesterday. And the kind of facts that you're suggesting would be arguably the basis for a legal challenge where someone would say it's a matter of a deprivation of equality for me who lives in Ohio and works for, let's say, IBM, that if I were working for IBM in Massachusetts, I would have more benefits, not because IBM wanted to give me more benefits in Massachusetts than Ohio, but because the state of Ohio is precluding this private corporation from extending to me the same benefits that it wants to extend to all of its employees. That is going to, you know, to have an equality challenge, you have to say that you're being harmed. And so you would argue that as the employee of IBM in Ohio rather than Massachusetts, you are facing harm because of the state's policies. And that would be one reason that you would argue the state of Ohio isn't permitted to treat you in that way.
Bob, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. So, Carla, even though they don't allow it in Ohio, general mood?
Oh, everybody's thrilled, of course. We were big parties last night all over the city.
Right after Pride.
Yes.
They weren't partied out enough, huh?
No, they weren't. And, you know, it just came off of a wonderful Pride with 300,000 people, many churches marching with us. Of course, our politicians marching, our corporations. You know, Pride started in 1981, and 75 people marched down High Street. And so, of course, you know, I posted, we've won no matter what happens today, meaning whatever happen with the Supreme Court, because of course the world is changing. It has been changing very quickly, and we kept saying House of Cards yesterday. So even though this only affected the issue three of DOMA, and we don't know what the states are going to have to do. Issue two has not been challenged, and probably, but we, you know, it's really it's a significant win for our community. Very, I mean, you know, people that have children. I was with Rick Neal yesterday, who adopted two children with his partner Tom Grody, and he just wanted to be with someone when the decision came down. So he was on his laptop, and he was so excited because, of course, they've been married. They have two small children, and even, you know, Judge Kennedy, of course, saying, Chief Justice Kennedy saying, well, you know, this is about children as well in California, that the with the Prop 8 case. Now their two daddies and their two mommies basically are going to feel the whole weight of the United States government is behind them, acknowledging and validating their relationship.
We talked earlier about the two groups in the state. Well, there's the national group that doesn't agree that it's time in 2014 to go to the ballot to overturn the constitutional ban on same-sex marriage in Ohio. Without getting into the politics of that per se and getting in between them, how does that affect the mood with the two different groups, in conflict like this?
Well, I think let's talk about the people in, at least in Columbus, Ohio, which is where I live. I don't run around the state of Ohio too often. Mm-hmm. But let's just say, you know, we've looked at all of these states that have ratified marriage over the course of these last few years. And, you know, Ohioans are just sitting there and they're going, gosh, why can't we get this done? And so I can see the urgency in our public basically saying, you know, we've got to get this done because we don't want to wait. Why are we being disenfranchised when all these other states are doing this? But let's face it, there still may be some states in the United States that will never do this. We need to talk to our congressmen and our legislators. You know, this is our Supreme Court does not want to legislate from the bench. That's what they're saying. They're saying, figure this out yourselves. Quit arguing, quit fighting, get your, you know, take care of it yourself and don't bring it to the Supreme Court every time you can't decide what to do. And so I think that, you know, probably this is, of course, America, and we're going to have a lot of folks that want to step up and they want to volunteer and they want to organize and they want to make change. And I think that that's just positive.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. Ruth Kolker, Distinguished University Professor and Heck Faust Memorial Chair in Constitutional Law at the Moritz College of Law at OSU. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Anne.
And also Mark Spindleman, professor at Moritz as well and specializes in family law. Mark, thanks so much as usual for joining us.
Thanks, Anne.
And Carla Rothan, it's like you never leave.
I'll come back anytime. I love being with you.
Carla Rothan, she's executive director of Stonewall Columbus. Thanks to all the listeners for all the great questions today. They furthered the conversation and we appreciate you always. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.